are listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM-LP, in Burlington, Vermont. Today is Monday, May 18th. I am Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Vermont author Jim DeFilippi. Born and raised in Duck Alley on Long Island, Jim DeFilippi has been writing and living on a dirt road in northern Vermont since 1973. He is a husband of many years, a father of two, a grandfather, a retired school teacher, a special needs bus driver, a Vietnam-era veteran, a popular speechmaker and storyteller, a former newspaper columnist, a former small-town newspaper editor, and a cigar maker. Jim has also written several novels, Cop, Cop, Lawyer, Jive Palace, Speedo, The Family Farm, Fog 50, Duck Alley, and Blood Sugar. Despite having been represented by a respected agent and having been published by such houses as HarperCollins and Permanent Press, Jim became fed up with the hassles of trying to find a publisher for each of his new books and eventually decided to make his novels available for download on his website, jimdefilippi.com. I spoke to him in early May, and we talked about that decision and other aspects of the writing life. I first asked him how he came to be a writer.
It started, I guess, when I came to Vermont in 73. I had done a little writing before that, but I've always wanted to do something artistic in addition to the teaching. I was a school teacher back then, and I looked around, and filmmaking was tough, and I tried songwriting for a while, and writing seemed to me in Vermont, it was the type place you could just connect and be established and do things, and I just took off from there.
Yeah.
I was never a writer as a kid, but yeah, that's how it started. It's been going on 40 years now, something like that.
Did you start out writing fiction, or did you write essays first, or how did you get started?
No, my first serious thing was a novel. And it was a novel that finally I just published on the website a couple weeks ago. Shows you how these things work. It was a Vermont novel called The Family Farm.
Oh, okay. So that was actually one of your first...
One of my first serious undertakings. Yeah, I remember in those days I hired a secretary at Winooski, the high school, to type up the manuscript for me and things like that. It was a different ball game. But I still am in love with novels. I've done a column for the Free Press, and I've done a lot of magazine work and... different things, but I just love writing novels. That's okay. What I do. Yeah. Every other novel I've written has been Queens, New York-based or Long Island-based,
right,
because that's where I grew up. And it's so much easier for me to write the dialogue of New Yorkers and the attitude and things, even though I've been up here, you know, since 74.
Well, that was one of my questions. Why was The Family Farm the only one set in Vermont? So that's why.
I still, to this day, have a hard time imitating the dialogue of Vermonters, imitating the frame of mind of Vermonters, the sense of humor. But you put two low-life Queens guys in a room and I could write their dialogue, boy, as fast as I can type, you know. And it's never changed. It's really, really funny. So as I may have said it on the website, I'm not sure, but my hope is that some of my old woodchuck friends, my old Vermont friends, will read this and say, he got it kind of right.
Oh, I thought you did. I actually, when I read it, I hadn't read about you yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was glad to read that you're not from here, because the attitudes of certainly the Vermonters in your book are very much sort of closed to outsiders.
Yes,
and,
yeah.
It was funny. I was feeling like such an outsider because I'm not from here. Nobody's from here, really.
No, that's right, especially Chittenden County.
Yeah, right. So how many generations do you think you have to be in Vermont to be a Vermonter?
I don't know. My daughter was born here. And my son was 2 months old, so I don't know if that's the cutoff point.
I've heard that doesn't count. I've heard that doesn't count.
Yeah, you're probably right. So I don't know. I heard a speech in the library just a couple weeks ago, and someone said, You're kind of a Vermonter if you can remember the DeGose brand unit. Do you remember the DeGose brand
unit?
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, that's pretty easy.
Okay,
then.
Good.
So we're both Vermonters.
I qualify.
Yeah, we both qualify.
And then it was UHC.
And then it was UHC, that's right. And I think now they call it the Given Health Center, or maybe maybe that was...
Yeah.
So we made the first cut, at least. I don't know if we were true blue, but we made the first cut.
There we go.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the family farm. Can you talk a little bit about it and what it's about and how the idea for it came to you?
Yeah, if I can remember. It's completely different from any of my other novels, and not only the setting and the dialogue and the syntax and things, but the fact that as a crime novel, it in a sense isn't a crime novel because the crime happens at the end. Mm-hmm. And as you know, crime novels don't work like that. Some people call me a mystery writer, which I'm not. I reject that title because to me a mystery writer is you read the book to figure out a mystery, to figure out who did it or how or what. And I've never written a book like that. I have written about crimes, and in every other novel I think I put the crime at the beginning, which is the way a crime novel should work. But I just wanted to, in that novel, build and show how violence just kind of gains momentum and grows and grows. Of all things, back in the 50s or 60s, I saw a Red Skelton show. I don't know if you remember Red Skelton.
Yeah.
He was an old comedian. And right in the middle of his comedy show, he did this supposedly comic skit about this guy who wouldn't move, and he was living in this little house, and the bulldozers were coming, and at the end the walls are pressing in on Red, and he's making silly jokes and getting squashed. And I knew there was a serious message there, and I said, boy, that would be a good book. So I seriused it up a bit.
Right.
This Family Farm is much more serious than most of my books. Most of them are just humorous. And I just wanted to show the how violence just kind of grows. So I started with a small act of violence, and then I went a little more, and then I had a bulldozer fighting a tractor, and then finally I have, I don't want to give away the whole thing, but, you know, attacks, mortal attacks,
right,
and fires and things.
Yeah.
So that's what I wanted to do.
Uh-huh.
Wanted to avoid the cliches, which I always try to do as a writer, and that was a little more difficult because it's easier to miss cliches when you're writing about Vermont, which again isn't my home state. I'm still a New Yorker. So yeah, that was basically the background of it.
I think too that when sometimes when people make mistakes with regional stories, it's in the dialogue, and your dialogue doesn't do that at all.
Okay, good.
You don't
thank
attempt
you.
To imitate regional speech.
Yeah,
dialogue.
It's real easy to do the eye up and you can't get there. Instead, yeah, and I tried to avoid that, you know. So as a result, I kept a lot of the dialogue short.
Yeah.
But again, what I said before, if this was New York, a New York dry cleaner who was trying to be put out of business, would have been a much easier book to write.
I wonder, maybe we should just talk a little bit about the plot. So maybe just give a little three-sentence thing about what it's about.
Yeah, it's about an old Vermont farmer who gets into a legal bind with his first wife's son's family because they have legal possession of part of his farm, and he just refuses to budge. He just refuses to give up any grounds. And so violence escalates and culminates in a tragedy, and all of them being destroyed in one way or another. Not a happy ending.
Yeah.
I guess that's as quick a plot summary as I can give.
So after reading this, I'm going to remember you as the king of subtle, slow-growing conflict. And there were so many issues sort of simmering.
Oh, thank you, because that's
surface.
Exactly what I was trying to do.
Yeah, and this book had, you know, the conflicts of family life, and then work versus creativity, man versus nature, and old wounds. And I was curious if you actively work to bring trouble to your characters. Trouble into their lives.
Yeah, I think I do. I think because of any dramatic situation, that's what you need. I think I infuse it. Yeah. Some writers will tell you they can go to the keyboard every morning and they'll say, oh, I can't wait to get there because I want to see what my characters will do.
Oh, yeah.
And I've never been able to do that. I say, hey, guys, it's a mystery book. Let's get up and kill somebody. So, yeah, I actively infuse this. And, again, I actively try to avoid the cliches. The farm wife, I think her name was Jen, I didn't want her a typical farm wife, so I gave her this kind of a high school outsider, promiscuous teenager type background, mm-hmm. you know, just to work against type a little bit.
Yeah,
but yeah, I try to do that.
To build it up.
Yeah, voluntarily.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I was also trying to decide as I read this who the bad guy was in Family Farm, and I couldn't find one. Everyone is flawed. Everyone is vulnerable in some way.
Yeah.
Sarah, perhaps more than anyone, is kind of blind to her own flaws.
Yeah. I think you're right, and I think it would have been so easy to make the Flatlanders the villains. I mean, that would have been a simple book to write. They come in and they're taking over, and I had to actively keep reminding myself not to make them villains. They're certainly, like you say, flawed. Both of them are.
Yeah.
But yeah, but there are no villains in this book.
Right. There's no real good guys in this book. I mean, everybody's got their little...
Exactly.
Humanity.
Yeah, that's right. And if any one of them, I guess, would have had one less character flaw, then probably the tragedy wouldn't have happened, you know? So
right.
It's a combination of things, yeah. Right.
Yeah. So one aspect of the plot is that the farmer in the story who owns the farm or, you know, earns his living on the farm is Warren. And he believes that a white-headed wolf lives on a part of his property called the Knob. And in protecting the property from the people that are coming from outside, from his first wife's family, he's sort of protecting the wolf as much as he's protecting himself and his own family. I thought that was interesting. I was wondering what the wolf represented for you as you wrote this.
Yeah, gee, you really hit it right on the head. That's exactly what I was trying to do. And another thing, going back to cliches, I originally had it as a catamount.
Mm.
Okay, you know, because it's a perfect example of a catamount, an animal that used to be around here. Some people believe it's still sighted, and other people say, no, there's no such thing. And I think in some drafts I actually did have it as a catamount, but again, it was my old idea of avoiding the typical and avoiding the cliche. And somewhere along the line, and I don't remember where, it turned into a white-headed wolf, but that's exactly it. And I don't know, maybe it was a little heavy-handed, but I even put the idea of the family. You know, in the title, Family Farm, the family is as important as the farm in all of these stories. And I think the wolf had a couple of pups trailing her,
yeah.
So that's exactly what I was trying to do. And put it, you know, maybe a little bit of an optimistic spin on things.
Yeah. I enjoyed the references to Ulysses that you sprinkled throughout this book. The adopted son remembers Warren as being sort of like the Cyclops.
Yeah.
Warren hears harpies in his head when he gets angry, and I thought those are like the sirens.
Yeah, you're
so
right.
So that was kind of fun listening to or reading this book and noticing these little mentions.
Yeah, there's obviously a certain power there and a certain narrative power that you can use, and you don't have to tell the whole story. So I did a little of that.
Yeah.
But again, and the more I think about it, this book is so much more serious than some of my other books.
Oh, it was a very serious book. Well, maybe this would be a good time. Well, now you're not going to read from the Family Farm, but maybe this is a good time for you to read from one of your books.
Okay, yeah. What I've chosen is one of my books that did see, I call it the paper and ink crowd, now that I'm an e-book writer. This is a book called Duck Alley, which is based on two kids growing up on Long Island. The way the book generated before I read from it is I had a bunch of stories, funny stories about me, that's actually me on there, and a buddy of mine growing up and some of the silly things we did. And I had a bunch of short little clips of some, you know, just two kids getting into goofy trouble. And I wanted to turn it into a novel, and I knew that wouldn't do it. I mean, it just wasn't going to see print. And so I said, well, what I've got to do is I've got to get a clothesline to hang these stories on. So my clothesline became this kind of tragic story where these two guys destroy each other without meaning to. And it worked nice, a nice counterpoint with these kind of funny stories. And a side issue, they wanted to do artwork of this photograph, so I refound this fella after we started kindergarten together in 1950 or 51, and we reconnected. And we've been emailing ever since.
Oh,
we email three or four times a week now.
Wow.
And when we both retired a few years ago, we went back to Duck Alley, which is a little section. There is really a Duck Alley, even though this is a novel.
Where is it? In Long Island?
On Long Island, yeah, North Shore of Long Island. And we did some crazy things. We're a couple of 60-year-old men, and we were sneaking over fences and trespass, just like we were kids again. But anyway, the section I'm going to read, the reason I chose it is, it probably came as close to poetry as I'll ever write. And what I used to try to teach my students in classes, poetry was just boiling things away and simmering things down till you just get whatever's left. When I was writing this book, and again, it's about growing up on Long Island in the 60s, 50s and 60s, I happened to be down there visiting my mother, and Newsday put out an 18 or 20 page supplement on what it was like to grow up on Long Island, and I said, this is perfect. And basically what I did there is I went through and just started throwing things out and just kept little phrases and beats and names and places of things I remember and just put them all together, and it became one of the paragraphs in this section. And as I say, if I'm ever going to write poetry, this is it. But anyway, here it is. This is from Duck Alley. And it's one man talking about what it was like back in those days and how he's going to tell the story. And his best friend is Albert.
Okay.
First person. In truth, to understand everything that happened to us as adults and how it all went, you first have to understand how deep Albert and I went back. If our friendship were Yankee Stadium, we two would be rooted together out behind the monuments in center field. Back when that was grass and clay and still in play, it was that deep. To explain things that happened later, I have to first try to show you about Duck Alley, the times back then, about the emotional equity that Albert and I had built up. It was a world where all the bikes were J.C. Higgins, all the cereal was Kix. And if it's quiet, and I listen even today, after all that's happened, I can hear the sounds of back then. Bazooka Joe, BB guns, bungalow bars if you missed the Gajuma man. I'd pronounce his name Majuga man. One Mississippi. Bruno San Martino, Bobo Brazil, and azalea bushes. In school, there were the walkers and the bus kids, and you diagram sentences. Stickball, stoop ball, punch ball, handball, American or Chinese. Killing a snake by chucking dirt bombs a couple miles from where Gatsby's mansion would have been. Two Mississippi. Spalding's and calling for a kid, hollering for him to see if he could come out and play. Playing in the gutter, going to buy a Coke if you had the money after the wiffle ball split and there was nothing left to do. Drinking the Coke in a place that delivered your burger on a Lionel train right to your stool if you had the money. Three Mississippi. PF Flyers and Philco televisions, black and white Dumonts receiving and exhibiting their magic from atop rotted and deserted potato fields. Earl Shive for $19.99 would paint any car any color. Gee, Earl, you mean red don't cost extra? A quarter for an Italian bread at King Cullen. A nickel for a Newsday. Dugan's home delivery trucks and Krug's. A crippled beer man who could hold two cases and jump backwards off the truck. Four Mississippi. A slingshot was a whammo. You got your whammo? You bringing your whammo with you? Wetson Burgers and Grumman's. He works at Grumman's. What do they do there? I don't know. Something with planes. You don't need an offensive line because the defense, they got to count before they charge. They got to count to five Mississippi. It was a time before I knew that the things that we would do and the things that we didn't would wreck the people that we knew so well and those we hardly knew at all. It was a time when just hacking around was an acceptable way to waste away the day. Hacking around, smoking some punk, guiltlessly burning up time. And when you were a few years older, burning both time and gasoline just to do it. Too often, the forward inertia of our lives gets our focus stuck straight ahead. And we forget that everything we see before us is being illuminated, shadowed, colored, and distorted by that mean flashing light that is coming from behind our own shoulders. The not real jumping shadow that we see blurring black in front of us, confronting us, is our own head. I figure that any story that's centered on good people getting crushed can only make sense if it's viewed with all of its pieces intact. At least that's how it finally came to make any sense to me. The two of us, Albert and I, could talk for hours back then, looking for a baseball in the weeds, sitting on a stump, carving sticks into pistols, mopping up the blood from some small and appreciated boyhood wound, just talking, bouncing words against the wall, using them to try to figure out how the world worked, always making things bigger and stranger and crazier than they really were. Sometimes things were so nuts that we didn't have to build them up so much, just remember them, and I was good at that. On August 17, 1957, Richie Ashburn, then with the Phillies, hit the same fan twice in one at-bat with foul balls. The first one busted her nose. Then Richie nailed her again as they were trying to get her out on a stretcher. How's that any less significant or impressive than Babe Ruth stepping out of the box in Chicago to call his own shot? Albert was good at telling stories, and I could remember stuff. We could talk about things like Richie Ashburn so easily, it was like talking to yourself. And there were other things that we couldn't talk about at all, and that turned out to be at the heart of what our life's misfortune was. Even today, things that come up that would be interesting to funny to only two people in the world, Albert and me. Not too long ago, someone said the name Nestor Shylock to me. I can't remember why. Albert would have remembered Nestor. He was an American League umpire, 1950s. Sure, other kids who grew up then would have known the name too. But only Albert and I would have then quick jumped from there to another ump, Augie Donatelli, who we always called Orgy Donatelli, back in an age when that word was mysterious and dirty, thrilling, and funny as hell. In some ways, what I'm giving you was a rose-tinted mirage of those days tucked in behind Northern Boulevard, where matchboxes and houses glow in sepia, where even the vanilla ice from the Good Humor Man would be slightly brown color tinted. Memories tend to be selective. I forget that for every time I came home to a house smelling of tomato sauce and baked bread, there was also a time of smelling my grandma's aglio olio with its garlic and anchovy odor that would drive me and my uncles from the house. On those nights, I would try to eat over at Albert's, hoping that they weren't having Naj Bimbagalia's fish hole casserole. My uncles used to call pork tenderloin buffalo meat, and they would describe during the meal their mother's heroic efforts to slay the beast. Pasta ai fagioli means pasta and beans, but my uncles pointed out, if you ain't been to school, it's pasta fazool. So I don't know if that's poetry or not, but that's as close as I'm going to get.
Thank you. That's great.
Yeah.
What year did that come out?
98.
And who published it?
The Permanent Press, a little prestigious place right on Long Island, and they loved it. It was nominated for some awards and things.
Great.
Didn't sell big, but I'm so proud of that book.
Yeah.
My brother is a very straight-laced engineering type, and he read it on a flight to Chicago, and at the end he was crying.
Oh, wow.
And he had to tell the waitress he had allergies. And when he told me that story, I said, oh, the book's a success. That's all I want. If I could make my brother cry, because it's a sad ending, I'm happy with it.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
I'm curious about the poetry within that section, the one Mississippi, the two Mississippi. How'd you come up with that?
Yeah, when we were kids, you would play a game of touch football. And since there was no line or blocking, you had to give the quarterback time to run the play. So you'd have to count to four Mississippi before you could charge the quarterback. And it just became a sense of meter, you know, a sense of timing. And, of course, some of the kids would count too fast. One Mississippi, two Mississippi. Oh, no, you counted too fast. You can't do that. And so, yeah, I just kind of punctuated with that. But all those other things, the Bazooka Joe chewing gum and
right.
The Lionel trains, it was all, in a sense, stolen from Newsday. I just boiled down that 20 pages or whatever it was.
Now, this is fiction.
It's fiction. And another thing it was nice, now that I think of it, my editor at the Permanent Press is a very bright, bright lady, Judy Shepherd, thought it was true. When she read the manuscript, she got back to me and started apologizing because, I don't want to give away too much, but the narrator, who really is Jim DeFilippi, destroys his friend, who's really my buddy Al, who lives in Seattle now. In truth, as I just told you, we're still the best of buddies
right,
and hacking
right,
around
right.
together. But she said, I'm so sorry. I know you fictionalized it a little, but you really destroyed your friend. And I said, nah, it's all
made up.
Yeah, I make this up.
I think you do a really good job of balancing the rhythm of story and dialogue and active scene and sort of flashbacks and memory. And I'm wondering if that's kind of a natural pacing for you, or do you have to work at that?
It came easier than I thought it would. You saw it in A Family Farm. In Duck Alley, it's even more so. It's a constant shifting back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And when I've read it, in other people's books. Because how I read novels now is I step back and I say, what's this guy doing and how's he pulling this off? I still enjoy them, but I don't just read them as a reader anymore. I kind of reverse engineer them. And whenever somebody would do that, the flash forwards, the flashbacks, the changing of tone, I was always amazed by it. And then I found out it's not all that difficult. I did it with, if we're still talking about Duck Alley, I just kind of interspersed things of when these kids were 12, of when they're in prison and they're 30 years old, and it just somehow works. And readers are pretty sophisticated. Right. I'm not so sure they've gotten more sophisticated over the years, but I bet they have, watching movies and things like that. They have no trouble jumping time frames and jumping scenes, mm-hmm. even in movies and TV shows and things now. Mm-hmm. They do it fairly easily.
Well, and in The Family Farm, anyway, which is the book that I've read most yeah. recently, it's very easy to follow. It's not like you're getting lost in the different time shifts. It's just,
yeah.
it's just an interesting interplay of... You know,
yeah,
weaving
and,
together.
And it's real. And I say this for any writers: give it a try. It's easier to do than you think it might. I mean, everybody thinks you start at the beginning and you know go to the end. And of course, you can structure a book that way. But other than cutting those first few chapters, as they always tell you, and maybe the last few, mm-hmm. that's one of the best things you can do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder if you can talk a little bit about revision. What's when you are revising a book? What's your what do you find you're mostly doing? Are you cutting or adding?
No, I'm doing a little of both. I'm enjoying myself. I think the actual part of getting the first draft down is really grunt work. It's just kind of getting it all out there. But once you've got a draft, I just love the cutting and the adding and the switching around. How I write books is a little different from most people. I was a school teacher, you know, for many years and had some time off in the summer. And now I take time off in the winter from my SSTA job. And what I do is during the work year, whether it's the school year or whatever, I block out a plot. And I'm one of those people who know exactly where I'm going, and I know what the last chapter is going to be about. And then I just write different notes and different ideas and things, and I put them into folders of, let's say it's 20 chapters, and then I'll get that rough draft done. And then it comes back to what you're saying, the revising, the changing, the switching. Mm-hmm. I guess the most important thing I do is I rake for cliches. I try to hold myself to the standard that if this line of dialogue or sentence has ever been written before, I don't want to use it. Mm-hmm. Now, I probably don't always use that. But if somebody walks in and says, hi, how's it going? I'm trying to get rid of that.
Yeah.
And believe it or not, it's fairly easy to do. You can write page after page of dialogue in every single sentence will be, at least I've never heard it before. Clichés drive me crazy.
Yeah.
They're in all things. I mentioned movies quickly before. I don't know if you've noticed, but the biggest cliché now over the last year is a guy walking away from an explosion, and he never turns back, and he's very casual, and you see the explosion behind him. I think it was, we're probably getting off the track here, but I think it was first used in a great movie called No Country for Old Men. I don't know if you saw that by the... all the brothers yeah. who have done them. And this very evil villain does it. And now every action movie that I see clips of on TV and every TV show has a guy walking away from an explosion without looking back. And
that sounds very James Bondian.
It is, yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, that's right. I bet in the poster for James Bond he's doing it. So anyway, that's what I wouldn't say mostly doing, but that's one of the main things I'm doing. But even when I think a draft is done, I'll be taking a walk in the woods and I'll think, oh, wouldn't that be a funny idea to put in there? And I'll run back and put it in. Computers are great, aren't they?
Yeah.
I started, you know, writing hard copy on a typewriter. And I remember my kids, when I wanted to add a page, I would hire them as little kids to go back with liquid ink and erase all of the page numbers so I could put different numbers in. But it's so easy and so much fun now.
Yeah. So much mm-hmm. easier now.
Oh, absolutely.
In The Family Farm, there's a line early in the novel that reminded me of the challenges of being a writer and trying to publish. Warren, the farmer, has been trapped under his wagon, and he works very hard to release himself.
Yeah.
And it's a great scene because it really establishes him as a very big, strong man, which you need to know about his character through the rest of the novel. But the line after he does release himself is this: "So much work and time and energy spent just to get back to where you belonged, back to where the work could begin." And when I read that, it just struck me that that is exactly how you feel when you've been trying to get published and you're beating your head against the wall, and really all you want to be doing is getting back to the creative work.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And not to depress you, but it just gets, at least for me, it just got worse every year. It was just, yeah, that's exactly it. All I want to do, I love the act of writing, and I just love the sound of the keyboards. I don't know if you can hear that. And just sitting up here and doing, my wife will be downstairs and my kids, when they're home, they yell. It's just like doing homework, Dad. Why are you up there? You don't have to do that. I say, I love it. I love it. But you're right. And then the work starts, and it's just so frustrating. You're always back to the first square. And I thought after my first published book was called Blood Sugar, and it was HarperCollins, and it was a really nice advance, and it was terrific reviews and some really, you know, Publishers Weekly and book lists and things. I said, oh, it's it. I've done it finally now. I'll write the next book. Oh, and I had a wonderful agent in New York who was just really a high-powered gal. So I said, oh, so it's finally happened. And it took 15 or 20 years to get to that point, okay? And so I wrote the character's name was Joe LaLuna. He's a cop, a New York cop. So I wrote my second Joe LaLuna novel, you know, and sent it off to my agent, get ready. And she said, nah, I don't want to represent this. And again, I can't bow to Mother because she's a wonderful woman, one of the true, honest agents I've met in New York. Her name is Lisa Bancroft for ICM, International Creative Management, and she's running with the big dogs now. She does the million-dollar contracts. But she was always very honest, and she just felt, you know, well, no, we're not going to make much money from this. So I was back where I started. So I scrambled around another few years and then put out Duck Alley, and then scrambled around another few years, and then decided to go with the website.
Right.
But you're right. You're always right at the beginning.
Right.
You know, you're always introducing yourself. And now I have some blurbs I can tell them about, and, hey, I got a book from HarperCollins, and they don't care. How many did you sell, kid? Well, not too many.
Right, So that brings me to my next question, which is your decision to publish all of your books online and make them available as free downloads. So can you talk about that a little
bit? Yeah, it was one very specific moment. I was on the phone with an assistant to an agent that I had worked off and on with for years, and I heard myself saying, gee, if you could just read the first 20 pages of this novel, I think you'd like it. And then I stepped out of myself and started listening to myself, and I'm thinking, she's a 20-year-old just out of journalism school. I can't do this anymore. When I first started, and again, this is going to offend people, but it doesn't matter at this stage of my career, I thought everybody in New York on Publishers Row, one, knew a lot about good writing, two, knew a lot about commercial books, because the two are different, you know. And it took me about 5 or 6 years, and I noticed a lot of these people don't know, just from my rejections and what they said, and they had read the book. I said, I mean, a lot of them are brilliant people, don't get me wrong, but a lot of them had no idea what good writing was. And again, I'm not just talking because I think I write good writing, I mean anybody's. And then a few years after that, I realized they also don't know what book's going to sell or not. They're just completely in the dark. And if, you know, if Harry Potter sells, all right, we better get some Harry Potter books out there, you know, or something like it. And so anyway, I went through that metamorphosis, and I'm talking to this gal, and I said, no, can't do it anymore. That's it. And then I was lying in bed maybe, I don't know, a week or so after that, and I said, wait a minute, my son knows how to do websites and stuff, because both my kids are computer guys. I could just put these books on online and have them downloaded. And he taught me about PDFs and getting your own website and getting on Kindle so you can sell your books on Kindle, the Amazon e-reader. And it's just been great. I mean, like, you're your own boss now. Whenever I want to put out a book, I'm going to put out 5 books this year. It's just terrific.
How are you finding the traffic?
Somebody asked me, because I have a friend of some of my kids who said, let me give you a counter for how many people visit your websites and how many people download. And I said, no, I don't want to hear that at all, because I have no idea.
The wow, Kindle you just sales, don't even want to know.
I don't want to know. I don't. On the other hand, the Kindle sales, when you get on the e-book, they send you a report. And I had 40 Kindle downloads last month, which I thought was great, because I don't know a soul who owns a Kindle. I've basically never even seen one.
Oh, I was going to ask you if you had a Kindle.
No, I don't. My theory is it's not going to work until they make a Kindle that looks exactly like a book, which is going to be very easy to do. All you need is two screens instead of one and a cloth cover, and forget the keyboard and stuff, have it all online. And so people my age, and maybe even your age, are going to feel like they're still reading a book and holding a book in their hands. My wife and I argue about this. She says, well, computers are going to do it. She's probably right. But there's going to be something.
Yeah.
When my grandkids go to middle school, they're not going to have those 50-pound backpacks that these poor kids use now. They're going to have a little book that math is going to be there and English is going to be there. And hopefully my novels are going to be there. You know? So I don't know. We'll see.
That's great. 40 downloads last month, and you know that 40 people are reading it.
Exactly.
That's very exciting.
And I have a very distant relative, a friend, well, a uncle of a brother, and I called him up and I said, you don't remember me. We met at a wedding, but somebody told me we had a Kindle. Could you buy one of my books? It's 80 cents. Just to let me know if it works or not. And he wrote back. He said, it's great. Came out perfectly.
Oh,
you know?
That's good.
And the only reason it's 80 cents, I want to put it on Kindle for free, and Amazon wouldn't let me.
So 80 cents.
Yeah. I've only been in one play in my life. I was in Guys and Dolls, and my first line was, how are you going to make any money from that? And that's what people always ask me. They say, it's a nice website, Jim, but how are you going to make any money from that? I'm not. I don't want to make any money. I just don't want to lose. It's just like $4 a month to keep the website active. And my Kindle sales are paying that. So it's very small, you know. Yeah, so I'm having a great time. You design the cover. You go out and shoot a photograph, and you flip it vertically, and you put the print on and stuff, and you do the flap copy, you know. So you're really a one-man publishing thing.
Yeah.
I'm going to start another website called Brown Fedora Books, where my books are not only going to be on there, but people I know and good books of people who want to be on. Again, they're not going to make any money out of it, but it's going to be fun.
Yeah.
It's going to be an e-book publisher. So I love it.
Do you have any regrets about this choice?
Not a one.
No.
Again, if I was younger and needed some money, there was a time I was teaching. It was very tiring. And I was saying, boy, it would be nice to be a full-time writer. So I would have loved to have signed that $100,000 contract. But to me, no, I got Social Security, I got teacher retirement, I got Medicare. No, not a regret. Yeah, maybe I'd like to see some of these books in book form.
Right.
But it's not as important as it used to be. When I first got this and Blood Sugar, I used to love holding it in my hand, you know, and say, oh, I got a book with my name on it. Doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah,
doesn't matter.
Yeah. What's your writing schedule like?
Now it's completely different, but what it used to be is doing notes and dribs and drabs and blocking out a novel during my work year, which went about 10 or 11 months, and then very quickly over the course of the summer, putting all of those notes that I had put into the different chapters in. People don't believe me, but Blood Sugar, which was my first book, which again made the most money and was HarperCollins and all of that, took me 2 weeks. I mean, I get up early in the morning and plug away for a couple of hours. Can't work late in the day. I just get really, really lazy.
So you write in the morning.
Write in the morning. But
when you're deep in a project, you're just writing a few hours a day? Or
Yeah. We mentioned Joe Citro before. He's a good writer friend of mine. He can sit, and I'm sure a lot of writers can sit for 8 hours, the old chair glue, and now 2 or 3 hours for me, and that's it.
Yeah.
But again, I'm incredibly fast, this process of having all your notes for your different chapters there. Makes it really nice. Yeah. So basically daily it's a couple, when I'm working, it's a couple hours in the morning and that's it. And the rest of the time just thinking. When I'm in the middle of a novel, I will spend a lot of time just kind of daydreaming, you know. I've been accused of being oblivious by friends and family alike. But I'm just thinking of something that would work in chapter 5 or work in chapter 4, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, and it's all a lot of fun.
What are you working on now?
I want to put together a book that's a combination of my early humor writing. And it's kind of cheating because the name of my website is the Crime Novels of Jim D. or the American Crime Novels of Jim DeFilippi, but I'm kind of skirting the issue by calling it Daily Malfeasance, because in every one, even though it's just funny things, there's the Italians have a word fregatura, which isn't really a crime, but it's not quite the way you're supposed to do things. It's a little sneaky, you know.
Yeah.
And in almost every one of these, there's some fregatura. So I'm calling it a book of short little things. And I've been going back and reading the old columns and things. My only problem technically has been, for some year, my 1988 columns are on one of these old 5 1/4 inch floppy disks, and I can't find anybody in Chittenden County who can read this thing. I'll call up Mad Dog and the other computer companies. I'll say, could you take some files off a 5 1/2 inch or 5 1/4 inch floppy disk? And they'll say, wait a minute, we'll go look in the back. And then they never come back. But anyway, that's what I'm working on now. It's called Everyday Malfeasance. I'm thinking I'll have it out in a month or two. There's a lot of other stuff going on. I don't know. In a couple months, I'll have that out.
Mm.
But that's what I've been doing.
What writers have influenced you?
One is Elmore Leonard, who's a great crime writer. Back in the 80s, when I was literally teaching myself how to write, there was a wonderful town librarian here in Colchester. They're still wonderful, but back then it was a lady named Hester Sweeney, and she would call me up whenever Elmore Leonard would have a book out, and I would run up there and be the first one to check it out. And he does so many things wonderfully, but the thing that just back then knocked me out of my seat, and I guess other writers have done it, he writes in the third person, but he'll take a character and he'll all of a sudden in that chapter be imitating the syntax and the vocabulary of that character, whether it's a street hoodlum or a lawyer or whatever. He'll stay in the third person, but you'll be hearing this person talking. He just did it beautifully.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I learned that from him.
Now, didn't Elmore Leonard never use metaphor?
Yeah, he says he's never written a figure of speech. Isn't that something?
Isn't that funny?
So what about the figure of speech? Never wrote one. Yeah. And the other is a fellow named George V. Higgins, who was a Boston writer, the friends of Eddie Coyle. And one of my proudest moments is he actually blurbed Duck Alley. It says it's a separate piece in Blue Collar, a wonderful book, and I was just so honored. What George V. Higgins taught me to do is use dialogue to actually, not just to add to a scene, but to do a scene. He realized that he wasn't writing for the movies. So if you had a bank robbery, instead of showing it with the shooting and things, have it the next day and have two of the robbers just talking about it. And it's kind of like you ever go into a diner and there's two people talking about something interesting in the next booth, and you don't quite understand it, but you're catching little snatches of dialogue, and it gets really interesting. You know, you find yourself leaning in and listening. George V. Higgins could write entire books that way, and it's a little frustrating for a while. But when I learned that, I just thought that was wonderful. So he's the second. My third, and it's just been very recent, is John Le Carré, the spy novelist. I never read spy novels. I don't even know what they are. But he's not a spy novelist. He's just a wonderful novelist. Unlike the first two guys I mentioned, he writes these big, long, flowing sentences that will go on maybe three lines, and a third of the way through, they'll take a sharp turn to something else. And then they'll take a sharp turn somewhere else. And then the last line is a third place they've been to. And it's just amazing.
Wow.
And every one of these guys I've written to, some of them aren't with us anymore. George Higgins passed away. And they write back, and it's just great. And then the last one died before I ever knew I was going to be a writer. But it's a wonderful English comedy writer named B.G. Woodhouse.
Oh.
Just the funniest guy in the world. I still read his books and just die laughing. And what I learned from him, and I still can't do it, is he has this very serious character named Bertie Wooster, who has a butler named Jeeves. And Bertie is the most serious guy in the world. And he'll write a completely serious story, and it's the funniest. He doesn't know it's funny, but it's the funniest thing in the world. And, of course, Jeeves, who's intelligent, knows that Bertie's a moron and says, yes, sir, I'll take care of that, sir. Oh, they're just wonderful.
Yeah.
But those four, those would be my big four.
What are you reading right now?
Oh, I read almost no fiction. I just finished for the second time reading a book called The Black Swan. And it's, I don't even remember the author's name or his nationality, but he's a scientist, and I just love it, although, I understand about a third of it. It has to do with these major occurrences that happen that nobody could have predicted, and yet change the whole world, and then the second you turn on C-SPAN, they explain it and they tell why it happened. It's like the 9/11 was a black swan. The stock market collapse was a black swan. But he explains that we live with them every day. And the reason they're called black swans is that for years people thought there were only white swans, and that's how they lived their life. And then they went to Australia, and there were black swans in Australia. And all of a sudden the scientists were explaining how it happened and stuff. So anyway, I've been reading that a couple times. And I read this other piece of psychology that I just brought back called predictable irrationality, which again is human beings are so irrational that you just have to base your whole life on that. You know, you put the word free on something and people are going to take it. Whether and that's it. I haven't really read a novel since the last Le Carré that I've really been blown away by. The last one, I guess, that really affected me was this thing called Absolute Friends that, again, John Le Carré wrote. And it's about these two buddies, and we all know them in our life. There's one kind of upstanding, nice guy, but then there's this other friend who every 10 years comes into his life and kind of messes him up and screws him up.
Yeah.
And some people are criticizing Le Carré now because he during the Bush years, he was getting too political and talking about how ridiculous all of this, this phony hunting for, or using any excuse to hunt for terrorists and stuff. And that was called Absolute Friends. So that's what I've been reading now, I guess.
Okay. All right. Well, my last question for you is for writers.
Yeah.
What advice do you have for writers who sometimes get stuck in their work or have trouble moving forward?
Boy, I would suggest, like some of the people I've already said, try a different attack. If you know you have to have a bank robbery or a love affair ending or a child being hit by a car in your book, but you just can't tackle that head on, try a George V. Higgins. Skip that and have the mother and father talking about it in the next... I do that as an exercise when I do workshops. Have the mother and father talking about it and let the reader find out about it through them. Now, you can't use that old phony... One person knows about it and the second doesn't, so the first is telling the first about it. I don't mean that. I mean, we've all seen plays where, you know, the butler answers the phone and says, "No, Mr. Johnson's not here now. He's at the funeral of his third wife who recently passed away." And, you know, you can just tell it's phony.
A little wooden.
Yeah, a little wooden, because he's not really talking into the phone. He's talking to the audience. So, I mean, both characters have to know what happened, and they're just talking about it, and tell your tale that way, or tell it through straight dialogue like that. That's just one example.
One great thing. Okay.
Yeah, give it a try. Both as an exercise and as a way of writing a book.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. Well, thank you very much for talking to me.
Oh, thank you. This has been great, Shayla.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Jim DeFilippi. Tune in again next week to hear an interview with Kimberly K. Jones, Vermont author of young adult books. Write the Book is brought to you in part by Autism Support Daily, Vermont's first online support group and host of the annual Autism Walk each October at Battery Park. More information is available at autismsupportdaily.com or 802-985-8773. We're also brought to you by the Lake Champlain Regional Chamber of Commerce, promoting and supporting a healthy environment that makes Burlington the ideal place to live, work, visit, and do business. Located at 60 Main Street in Burlington and online at vermont.org. And also by Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, building a brand new economy with old-fashioned values. Learn more at vbsr.org. Here's the Bookworm's calendar for the coming week. The Dorothy Alling Memorial Library presents filmmaker Jay Craven discussing the arts in northern New England tonight at 6. The Brownell Library in Colchester presents author Anne McKinstry Miku speaking about her three novels set in Vermont, Wednesday, May 20th at 7. co-author of the book Gloves. Alan Rubel will speak about the history of Golden Gloves amateur boxing in Vermont. This event, part of the Aspects of Vermont series, takes place at the Kellogg Hubbard Library in Montpelier, Wednesday, May 20th at 7. Economist, educator, and author David Collender will be at St. Michael's College Wednesday, May 20th at 7 to take a fresh look at today's financial situation. More information is available at 802-862-9355. The Fletcher Free Library presents authors Eric Siegelstad and Josh Hunter discussing their book, The 27s, The Greatest Myth of Rock and Roll, on Wednesday, May 20th at 7. In honor of its new bookmobile, the South Burlington Community Library will hold a ribbon-cutting ceremony and picnic from noon to 2 on Saturday, May 23rd at the Rotary Bandshell in Dorset Park in South Burlington. More information is available at 802-652-7080. Phoenix Books and Cafe presents New Yorker cartoonist, cover artist, and children's illustrator Harry Bliss discussing his newest book and first comic book, Luke on the Loose, Saturday, May 23rd at 11. Today's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Jim DeFilippi, who suggests trying what he calls a George V. Higgins. Rather than writing a particular scene head-on, perhaps let the reader find out about an event in a second-hand way. Two characters who know what happened can talk about it after the fact, filling in detail and background through dialogue. Jim cautions that the scene should not entail one person recounting for the other what happened, but that the two characters should both understand the event and have a conversation that in turn informs the reader. A copy of this prompt will be included in the description to this week's podcast. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or events for next week's Bookworms calendar, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And now stay tuned. Cheryl Willoughby and the World of Music starts at 3. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you are listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMM LP in Burlington, Vermont.